TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Professor Peter Wadhams, The Fate of the Ice Sheet on the Top of the World. In early 2019, news about accelerated melting in Arctic and Antarctic made me return to trusted sources. In the most recent TUC program, you heard Professor Eric Vigneault explain the connection between ocean warming and the mass loss of the West Antarctic glaciers. For the Arctic, I return to Professor Peter Wadhams, the UK's most experienced sea ice scientist, professor of ocean physics at the University of Cambridge. In an age of exploration, where computer models often dominate, his research is special because he actually did decades of fieldwork on and under the ice in submarines. As opposed to the Antarctic, that is a continent of mountains and valleys covered in ice, the North Pole is an ocean covered with an ice sheet that touched the coastlines of Greenland, Canada, Alaska, and Siberia for 100,000 years. In only 30 years, the retreat from the coastlines during the Arctic summer accelerated, and an ice-free Arctic in September may occur as early as 2020, and the Arctic winter is no longer cold enough to restore the levels. Peter Wadhams has made more than 50 expeditions to both polar regions. In his most recent book, A Farewell to Ice, he describes in vivid detail the changes in the Arctic and the danger they pose to the world's climate. Dave Ballas runs a YouTube channel that he named Just Have a Think. He sat down with Peter Wadhams in late November 2018 and asked to be brought up to date on the current situation and the prognosis for the future. My thanks go to Dave for his permission to use this excellent interview. Here's Dave.
Well, welcome to Just Have a Think, and I'm very happy to be here with Professor Peter Wadhams. Peter, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. It's a pleasure to meet you. Just for the handful of people who may not be aware of your body of work, can you give us just a sort of summary of what you've been up to and how you got into it and what the main emphasis of your work has been over the years?
Well, I got into Arctic sea ice research kind of by accident. I mean, I always wanted to be an oceanographer, partly because my family had been sailors, but I was very keen on physics at school, so a way of combining physics and going to sea was to become an oceanographer. So when I first graduated, I got a job on an oceanographic ship for a year, and the Canadians were doing the first circumnavigation of North and South America. It's still the only one that's ever been done by a ship called the Hudson. I really wanted to be a traditional oceanographer, which means you sail around in the tropics and sunbathe. But unfortunately, I got sold on sea ice because we went down to the Antarctic and worked in ice-covered seas. And then we came up back through the Northwest Passage and had a very interesting time getting stuck in the ice.
Right.
And so in those days, there was very few people working on sea ice. The first conference I went to on it, were, I think the entire population of the world of sea ice researchers went to it. It was in Iceland. And they hadn't had a conference on sea ice for 13 years. And so everybody went, and there was only 80 people. That was the whole world population of sea ice researchers. So I was the kind of official university scientist, really, attached to the Navy whenever they sent a submarine to the Arctic.
What do you think, what's been the extent of ice loss since you've been, I mean, you've been looking at it for, what, 40-odd years?
Yes, it's huge. We can always measure the loss of area of ice from satellites because they can see the difference between white and dark.
Yeah.
So it was known that the ice area was shrinking by about 3% a decade, some low rate of shrinkage, but it gradually meant that the summer ice started to shrink back from the coastlines of the Arctic. So instead of even the summer ice cover filling the Arctic Ocean, it was shrinking back a little bit, allowing a the existence of a Northwest Passage and a Northern Sea Route, if you're lucky. But then the rate started to accelerate, and nobody had looked at actually how thick the ice was, although it's pretty obvious, really. It's, if the ice shrinks and it has to melt, and if it's going to melt, it's got to get thin first. Yes. So yes. The average thickness should be going down. So I started asking the Navy to take the submarine over the same track each time. And so we did two tracks that were identical over the Arctic Ocean from Greenland to the pole in 1976 and 1987, so 11-year gap. That gap resulted in a 15% decrease in thickness. That was, so I wrote that up, and that was the first report on thinning of ice in the Arctic. But the 15% was just a starter, because then the next voyage we did in the 90s, it was up to 43% loss of ice.
Wow. Loss of thickness?
Loss of thickness.
Yeah.
And it's more, it's at least 50% now loss of thickness, but because of the shrinkage as well, it's 3/4 of the ice has gone. Mm. The downward trend is so strong that it really is going to get rid of all the summer ice very soon, and it won't come back.
Can you give us a layman's sort of snapshot of why that's such a dramatic forcer of the climate issue?
Yes, well, when you have sea ice, especially if there's fresh snow on top, then its albedo, which is the fraction of solar radiation that's reflected straight back into space, is about 80 or 90%. But open water is less than 10%. It's the biggest transition in albedo on the planet, if you have ice, sea ice, and you take it away, or snow and take that away. That means a huge amount of extra energy absorbed by either the sea or the land. Just the loss of sea ice is equivalent to adding 1/4 to the warming effect of the CO2 we're adding to the atmosphere. And then also we're finding that the area of snow in the northern lands, the Arctic and the subarctic, that's going down, and it's gone down by about 6 million square kilometers. Okay. So that's as big a loss, or even bigger loss, than the loss of sea ice. Mm. So if you add the two effects together, it's now more like 50%, a 50% increase in the rate of warming just due to the loss of snow and ice. So yeah. So it's already the case that if you kind of switch on, start your SUV and emit 2 molecules of CO2 from the tailpipe, then nature or Arctic change is giving you another molecule as well to add to the effect, which is due to the retreat of sea ice. Mm.
Which isn't reflected necessarily in these concentration pathways that the IPCC
uses. The IPCC is very slack in incorporating all these feedbacks. They tend not to do it very well, and so their predictions tend to be complacent, I think, is the word, or false is another word. But this one is, I think, one of the alarming ones, because other feedbacks are things that may or may not happen, like methane loss, but albedo is definitely happening, because we're losing area of snow and ice, replacing it with darkness.
Just a scientific fact. So even in the IPCC report, they've said that the Arctic has warmed by 1.9 degrees Celsius just in the last 30 years, and that's reducing the differential between the mid-latitude warmer regions and the Arctic cold region, which, as I understand it, is having an effect on the jet stream.
It is an effect where it implicates sea ice and Arctic warming very strongly. And the person who originated the theory is Jennifer Francis from Rutgers University. And most people agree with her analysis now that what's happening is the Arctic's warming about 4 times as fast as the rest of the planet. So the difference in temperature between the Arctic air mass and tropical air masses is getting less. Because the temperature difference has gone down, the driving force for the jet stream is less. So the jet stream slowed down, and as it slows down, instead of being a straight line, it goes into lobes, north-south lobes. Okay. It's like a river flowing over a flat estuary. It tends to meander. So you've got a meandering jet stream, and with a meandering, it means that Arctic air is carried down to much lower latitudes than it should get to. And then in between, there's regions where tropical air is carried to much higher latitudes. So Europe seemed to have escaped this, but beginning of this year we had this beast from the east, which was exactly this thing that you had: extremely cold air covering Europe and extremely warm air in the Arctic. The Arctic was 30 degrees warmer than normal. In fact, it was above zero at the North Pole. And the problem with all that is these extreme events will keep happening now, because that's the way the jet streams become. We're not going to escape from either extreme heat or extreme cold events during the winter. It's not extreme weather we're getting, it's extreme climate, that the climate has changed. And it's changed in an unpredictable way. These events, you can't predict them, but they have a big impact on mid latitudes in the Northern Hemisphere. And that's exactly the place where most of the world's food is grown. So therefore you have revolts and uprisings and warfare even. And you find the years in which food prices are very high are years in which you have the Arab revolt and the big uprisings in Tunisia and all over the Middle East.
So you mentioned earlier about methane in the Arctic, and I've heard about people talking about methane bursts. It all sounds very dramatic. So what that's about and how quickly it might happen, or what the prognosis is for that?
Well, it could happen very suddenly, and I think it's the greatest single threat that we face, but that's not generally recognised by the IPCC. And the origin is this fact that the sea ice is retreating in summer. So what we used to have in the Arctic is a very interesting ocean, because the centre of it is very deep, like most oceans. It's 4,000 metres deep, but it's got the widest continental shelves of any ocean. And so this whole area around the edge of the Arctic, which is the seas north of Russia, basically, the East Siberian Sea, Laptev Sea, Kara Sea. These are very wide shelves, and the shelves are incredibly shallow, only 50 to 100 metres deep. So it's like a swimming pool with a very shallow end and a very deep end.
Right.
So that you've got 50 to 100 metres going out right up into the middle of the Arctic, virtually. Then suddenly it goes deep and you have the very deep ocean. Now, the trouble is that the summer retreat of sea ice has taken it back into the centre of the Arctic Ocean. So the deep part of the Arctic Ocean still has an ice cover in the summer, but the shelves don't. The ice has completely gone off the shelves. And so we have open water and shallow open water as well. So that means in the summer, when you're getting lots of solar radiation, that radiation is hitting a shallow layer of water and warming it up. So instead of the water temperature staying at zero, which is what would happen in the past when we still had ice, the water temperature has risen to several degrees. 3 years ago, it was 11 degrees up here. So if you look at 11 degrees, that's the temperature of the North Sea at Scarborough, I think. People go swimming. So with those temperatures, when in the past you always had zero or less, it has a dramatic effect on the seabed, because the seabed is like a pressure cooker. It's got a layer of permafrost left over from the last ice age. That's holding down several hundred metres of sediments which are full of methane. And as soon as you release the pressure, that turns back into methane gas and comes out. We did an analysis in Nature, which was based on an estimate that only maybe 8% of the methane came out. That's still 50 gigatons a year. And that would have an impact, climatic impact, of increasing air temperatures worldwide by 0.6 of a degree.
So if I'm right, then the average, the CO2 output at the moment is about 40 billion to 40 gigatons, isn't it? 40 billion tons. And methane is, what, 23 times more powerful than CO2?
Yes. So
there could be 50 billion tonnes of that coming up.
So that would be a one-year burst that would have an impact at least 20 times the impact of CO2. So it will be a catastrophe, because the temperature would suddenly rise. It wouldn't be rising smoothly, but it would rise by... Even with 8% of the methane being released, it gives you 0.6 of a degree warming straight away. So it baffles me that that IPCC has not taken account of that in its assessments.
I know you've been on record as saying that you feel that the prognosis in the IPCC report is pretty woefully underplayed, and there, you know, obviously the Paris Agreement was 2 degrees maximum and aspire to 1.5, and then this latest IPCC report has come out. They're saying it's even more important that we now shoot for 1.5 degrees maximum, but it seems to me that that looks less and less feasible as every day goes by.
Well, I think it never was really feasible. Even the IPCC's own analysis said we've got to reduce emissions to zero by 2050. And we can't. And they're not even decreasing at all. They're still increasing exponentially. Yeah. The CO2 level in the atmosphere is still going up at an unrestrained rate, when the signing of the Paris Agreement didn't produce a sudden decrease in CO2 levels or CO2 emissions. They just kept going up. The world didn't notice. If, for instance, an asteroid was spotted heading for the planet, then the whole world would mobilise to do something about it and kind of launch some giant mass of nuclear weapons to try and divert it. We wouldn't just sit there supine and let it hit us. But because climate change, which is going to be just as destructive, it's going to make human life impossible, but because it will take decades to happen, everybody from day to day can sort of think, oh, I don't need to do anything now, I'll do something sometime in the future. It's a natural human reaction. You really, to face up to this need for 1.5 or 2 degrees restriction on warming, you have to completely trash immediately all fossil fuel power stations. Yeah. You have to stop drilling for oil, stop digging coal, get rid of fossil fuel power stations, replace them with solar, wind and nuclear immediately at huge cost, and people will object to paying that cost. Stop people from driving big cars and make it necessary to have an electric car if you're going to have a car. Yeah. Change people's lives to such an extent that people wouldn't tolerate it. If there isn't an immediate threat, if there isn't that asteroid heading for us, they won't do anything. So it won't get done. And that's my fear. It's not a fear. I think it's a prediction. We won't see any reduction in carbon emissions. Far from reducing them to zero, it will shoot up to the point where we can't get it back down. And rightly, I think IPCC say, if we don't start to seriously reduce emissions within the next 2 years, we'll never get them down to a level that will save us.
I have recognised that the biggest issue I think we have is getting the message. You put it forward in a very, very easy to understand way, but I've listened to a lot of really technical presentations that you know, and I'm not a stupid guy, I'm fairly intelligent, but I've had to really try hard to understand, and actually even reading the IPCC report, why use one word when 53 will do? It's a very verbose report, and it's almost an exercise in demonstrating one's vocabulary expertise rather than trying to get a message across in words of one syllable, and that's part of the issue.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's really bad. I've always felt that in science, that if you can understand a concept, you can get it across to an intelligent layman. It ought to be possible to explain any concept in science. And if you can't explain it, then it's probably wrong. Made some mistake or something.
Yeah.
If you can't get something across. And of course, scientists don't often like that, because they like to be able to maintain the mystique rather than saying something that everybody can understand, because when everybody understands it, everybody will say, oh, we always knew that. Everybody's saying about the Arctic, we always knew that the ice was going to disappear. In fact, everybody said it's not going to disappear.
Suddenly changed their tune. Yeah. So you're just back from Italy.
The meeting was called by the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, the Vatican Science Group, and by the Italian government lab, CNR.
And you were talking about the global sea level rises, so that obviously not an insignificant factor in global warming either. So what's the prognosis for that, with the various temperature rises that we are likely to get?
Well, the prognosis, as in most things, seems to be acceleration. All the bad things are accelerating. And the sea level rise is, again, one of those bad things. It's accelerating and it's been underplayed by IPCC. Mm. And again, you can see why. Well, you can say it's for cowardly political reasons, because if you underpredict how much sea level is going to rise, then in the summary for policymakers, then the policymakers can take a lower value for the sea level rise rate, so they don't have to spend so much on raising the heights of flood defences. So it's really nasty and evil, but you can see the temptation for the people who oversee the IPCC reports. That's government people have an input after the scientists have said what they want to say. The summary that goes to policymakers is overseen by politicians, and they tend to weaken the predictions. So the worst case of this was sea level rise, and the IPCC was predicting in 2007 something like 30 centimetres of sea level rise by the end of the century. So that went out to policymakers. They thought, oh, great, we don't have to do that much. We can just raise the heights of flood defences by
about
30 centimetres. Yeah. But then the last assessment, they took account of the fact that the Greenland ice sheet and Antarctic ice sheet are melting at an accelerated rate. And we now know how fast they're melting, because there's a satellite now, a gravity-based satellite, which measures how much stuff there is underneath it. So as the Greenland ice sheet shrinks, it's possible to exactly map how much ice there is left in Greenland. So that's called the GRACE satellite. It's a wonderful thing. And we now know that Greenland is losing mass at about 300 cubic kilometres a year, and Antarctica is starting to lose mass. It's up to about 100, and that's greater than any other source of water going into the ocean. All the other glaciers in the world are already retreating, and most of them are going, and the warming of the ocean doesn't do that much. It's Greenland and Antarctica that are now the drivers of sea level rise, and the more we measure processes in Greenland, the more we conclude that sea level is rising in an accelerated way, because the melt of the Greenland ice sheet is accelerating. So that the warming of Greenland, giving accelerated loss of ice from the surface in the summer, gives you accelerated deposition of fresh water into the ocean, gives you accelerated sea level rise. And so it's again a feedback loop, and it's not easy to get around it. Many people think, well, if we can deal with global warming and stop the rate of warming, then that stops sea level rise as well. But it doesn't. The sea level rise is partly based, because you're dealing with very thick ice sheets, there's a flywheel effect going on, that once the melt of Greenland gets going, it doesn't matter if we stop global warming. It'll take a long time before the melt of Greenland stops happening, the melt of Antarctica. So the sea level, accelerating sea level rise, will keep on going even if we deal with air temperatures.
So, right.
And the problems there, of course, are loss of coastal cities, because this 30 centimetres has already gone to a metre, and now a lot of glaciologists think it will go to 2, 3, or 4 metres as the sea level rises.
By 2100 or so.
Yes, by 2100.
Yeah, yeah.
So that would be pretty catastrophic. We lose a lot of coastal cities completely. And again, because sea level is global, it's not regional. You're not going to save one place, like Miami is trying to save itself by pumping water out to sea, which is a bit like King Canute.
Yeah.
And
also higher, presumably, if that higher sea level that's a global average across an entire planet, when it surges, well, you've got more energy anyway, and hurricanes start whipping it up, presumably you've got a bunch more water to surge with. So those surges across cities are going to be a whole lot more dramatic as well, presumably.
I think that's going to be the worst effect. I mean, there was a lot of studies done on storm surges after 1953 floods in the Netherlands and Britain, and because I'm I know about that because, first of all, I was alive. And secondly, my grandparents' house was flooded.
Really?
In Tilbury. Oh. And when you look at the sea level rise associated with that, it was a storm surge in the North Sea with a very strong northerly wind just piling water up against into the Straits of Dover at a time when it was high tide, and so the water just spilled over. Mm. That kind of thing keeps happening, but if it's happening on the basis of a higher average level, then everything is worse. So the only way to stop things being worse is to raise the heights of seawalls around the entire planet to the same amount as the rise in sea level. So that's why it's very important that we get the rise in sea level right, get the predictions right, because that's how much we've got to raise sea walls.
So we build once rather than continually.
Yes. So I think the planning for London is quite good. They've got contingency plans for building another Thames barrier downstream. Mm-hmm. And I talked to the person, in fact, I went to a meeting in China with the Chinese Academy of Sciences, which had a British delegation, including the guy who's responsible for the Thames barrier. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese delegation that was really worried because they were using low values for sea level rise, and places like Shanghai, which is full of canals, they didn't know how much they had to raise the heights of canal walls. Even Britain isn't okay. And certainly a place that hasn't got any sea walls, like Bangladesh, is in a terrible state.
Yes.
It's poor. There's, I think, 20 million people live within 2 meters of sea level.
Right.
As sea level rises, and also you get storm surges in the Bay of Bengal with the wind driving water up into the head of the bay, you get a storm surge. If you have a higher sea level, you get more flooding. So you get catastrophic floods. You already do around Bangladesh coastline, and people can't afford to retreat because there's another 20 million people living behind them saying clear off.
Yeah.
And then they can't raise the heights of sea defences, so they just die. Mm. And that the frequency of these catastrophic events is going to go up, and that's probably be the main immediate effect of sea level rise is going to be increase of deaths in poor countries because of storm surges.
Yes.
And then loss, and then economically it's going to be loss of cities in rich countries because you can't maintain them against the sea level rise, like New Orleans or Miami. Mm. That these cities have to be abandoned.
That was Professor Peter Wadhams, sea ice scientist and director of the Scott Polar Institute in Cambridge until 1992, and professor of ocean physics. And thanks to Dave Borlas for allowing me to use his interview with Peter Wadhams for radio. You can see a longer version on Dave's YouTube channel, Just Have a Think. He posted in late November 2018. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.